Blog Talk Radio.
To be the man, you gotta beat the man. You wanna find out how good you are? You're looking at the measuring stick. Let's go, hook him up!
Welcome to another edition of Over the Top Radio. I am your host, Ed, in San Antonio, and I'm currently joined by my co-host, Crazy Night here. He had a family thing. But I got my other co-host, Katrina. Oh, wait, Katrina's not doing the show tonight either. Well, don't worry. Hopefully, you won't just be stuck with me. I just talked to Dave Meltzer just a minute ago, and he told me to call him back in 5 minutes. So hopefully Dave will be able to pick up. It's a busy day. Fortunately, Matt Bourne passed away today. Point the Clown or Big Josh in WCW. He was like a lumberjack. And, he passed away. And he wasn't very old. I think he was just in his, 50s. He'd been around forever, though. I mean, he's been around since before I started watching, that was a long time ago. I mean, the first I heard of Matt Bourne, I think I probably might have seen his name in the Aftermags in Portland. I know I would read about him being in Mid-South. He was part of the Rat Pack with Ted DiBiase and, I can't remember who was in there right now, but, yeah, he was in Mid-South. And then he went to he got traded or something. He probably got in trouble. That's one thing he always did was get in trouble. So he was going to Georgia, and he kind of needed a tag team partner, and he didn't really know who to ask or bring with him. And apparently in the dressing room, the Junkyard Dog was talking to him that he should take this one kid. Take this kid over here. He looks like an Anderson. Make him an Anderson. And basically, the Junkyard Dog invented Arn Anderson. And so Arn Anderson and his fedora showed up on Georgia Championship Wrestling with Matt Bourne. And they were on for a couple weeks, and then Matt got in trouble. I'm not sure the whole story, but allegedly, he had sex with an underage rat. I think a lot of guys in Portland had that trouble. And he had to leave, instead of them being the big tag team, they brought in the Road Warriors, and then from there, the rest is history, as they would say, because, you know, everybody knows about the Road Warriors, one of the most famous tag teams of all time, and that started a big, big run for them, and I remember it all. I remember watching it all as a little kid every Saturday. It would start at 5:05. Central Time on WTBS. There was actually a W in front of the T, I watched them, and then of course Matt Bourne went to WWE as Doink the Clown, which would be his most famous role. And honestly, I couldn't tell you when he stopped being Doink the Clown because other guys took his place: Ray Apollo, Steve Lombardi, Chris Jericho, a bunch of guys. And I do remember him having a nice run as Big Josh. I actually liked that. He actually would have awesome matches with Arn Anderson, speaking of the devil. But it's around the time that Dave told me to call him back. And quite honestly, there's going to be some dead air unless I can find something to play here. So let me see if I can find something to play real quick, and then I will call. I'm definitely not playing the Meltzer shoot. I'm going to play the second Memphis clip, and then I'll just stop that when I'm back, hopefully.
Everybody said we sneaky Jeff. Jarrett said that we call it Jeff. I tell you what, we not call it or sneaky Jeff. We are Imperial Supreme Japanese. We tell you now. I'm going to do now.
Oh,
if
no.
Jeff Jarrett comes in the TV today, I'm going to beat him up, and I'm going to paint his back yellow streak, and I'm going to beat his back with his belt like a dog. And
you don't need that paint in here. Why don't you just get it out of here?
Jarrett, bring his retarded son. I tell you what, I'm going to beat him up with his boo-weep whack.
Hey, Dave, I'm sorry to have to have you do the show on what would be a busy news day considering what happened earlier. And I was just talking about Matt Bourne before I called you. And what do you have to say, or what do you know about what happened?
I haven't really heard the details or anything. I just heard that he was found by his girlfriend this morning, and that's really all I know.
Mm-hmm. Now, he was still active, right? He wasn't retired or anything, was he?
He was doing independence. I mean, I don't know how super often, but he was in New England over the weekend at like they had a convention Saturday within a Hall of Fame thing, for New England Hall of Fame, and he was there. So he was still around. Yeah, he was hanging out with Marty Jannetty.
Yeah, I had Marty Jannetty on my Facebook, and he was freaking out and losing his mind about it because he was trying to find out if it was real.
Yeah.
He just talked to him yesterday.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah, and I did notice on when I was scanning my Facebook, I guess he really has been working a lot because I have a bunch of, different independent wrestlers, and everybody was posting pictures, like a guy in Carolinas is posting pictures, a girl from New Jersey is posting pictures with her and him, a local girl from here in Texas was posting pictures. So, yeah, he was making the rounds up until, at least a few years ago.
Yeah, even now. I mean, I would see his name, from time to time.
Yeah. And the first that I remember of Matt Bourne was basically reading about him in the Aftermath. He was part of the Rat Pack.
Yes, that's 82-ish in Mid-South. Yeah, I mean, I remember him when he first got started in Portland, and he was like the young guy, the son of Tony Bourne, who was the, ex-high school wrestler who they were starting out, and he was starting out as an opening match guy doing draws and things like that. And then, he was going higher and higher on the card. And, within a few years, he was main eventing a lot, especially when he did the feud with Buddy Rose. That was kind of like, it was actually a weird angle because Buddy Rose married her sister and then they got divorced. So then they did the Buddy Rose, Matt Bourne feud. Matt Bourne was like a top baby face and Buddy was the top heel, and Buddy married Matt's sister for real, which, became like a really weird deal. And so they ended up teaming some, and then Buddy divorced Tony Raybourne, and Matt and Buddy had the big feud after that. So it was, that was kind of like a real life angle that was actually a pretty big deal. I thought it was kind of innovative at the time because, they used real life that, when people knew that, Buddy had really married into the family.
Yeah. I never ever saw any Portland, but I do remember always reading about them in the Aftermath, and they always seemed to have like really interesting stories going on.
It was a weekly territory, and, when Buddy was there, even before, even in the 70s, it was a gritty weekly territory that did reasonably well. It had a good television, that a lot of people watched the TV, and, Portland, they had that 3,000 seat arena and they filled it a lot. And it was a for that size of a territory, for that style of a territory, it was a very well-paying territory. In the 70s, it was anyway. I mean, the guys that were there loved being there. The drives weren't bad at all. It wasn't, and, you know, it was actually a pretty good territory for lifestyle and everything. Yeah, but Matt came, I won't say the tail end, because he was there in the early 80s. It was still pretty strong. You know, Matt, you know, I mean, in those days, to make a name, you went all over the place. You know, that was what you did. You would be in a place, then you would leave for a while. You would go to a new place. You would, you know, spend your 6 months, 9 months there. That way, when you came back the next time, you know, every time Matt came back, he could be a bigger star because he'd had more success elsewhere. I mean, he went to the Carolinas with Buzz Sawyer, and they were Mid-Atlantic Tag Team Champions. And
I remember the first time on Georgia when him and Arn Anderson and Arn Anderson's fedora showed up for the first time.
Right. Hold on. This phone's dying, so let me switch.
Okay.
Yeah, they were the, you know, if it wasn't for Matt Bourne, I don't know if there ever would have been a Road Warriors. Because Matt Bourne and Arnie Anderson were brought in to be Georgia Tag Team Champions, and then Matt got into trouble with a girl. I don't know what exactly was. It was like a sexual assault type of thing. He had to get out of town, and they had no tag team champion, so Ole went to Minnesota to Eddie Sharkey, and Eddie, you know, had four or five guys he was training, and you know, I think that he wanted Animal and Rick Rude as the team, and Ole picked Mike Hegstrand and Joe Laurinaitis to be his team, brought him in, and that's how the Road Warriors debuted. And then, you know, he brought in Rick Rude and Barry Darso pretty quickly after.
Yeah, I actually remember Animal coming in before.
Yeah, a year earlier. He worked one or two TVs, then he went to the Carolinas where he was used as a job guy, and then he quit and went home. And then Animal had pretty much, you know, washed his hands of wrestling. Hawk had pretty much washed his hands of wrestling. He'd gone to Vancouver and hated it. And, you know, they were – but you know, Ole must have met him at some point through Eddie Sharkey, and then he brought them in.
Yeah, I remember, like, they were going for the biker gimmick with Animal at first, but the way they had him dressed, he looked like he was out of the Village People. So
Yep, he sure did.
As big and scary as he looked, he kind of had a gay look to him. So
the part of the problem too is he was so green at the time. I mean, they still were in '83, but in '82 he was like, when I watched it was just like, wow, this guy, you know. I mean, he basically just went in there and killed a guy. I was like, this guy doesn't know what he's doing at all. And in '83 they had, you know, whether it was more direction or whatever it was. I mean, they still were killing people, but they were killing people in a more of a working way.
Yeah. I remember them killing Mike Jackson pretty much every week for, like, years.
Yeah, it was – well, Mike Jackson was awesome because he was, like, 170 pounds, so it made those two guys, you know, look like they were, you know, just gigantic. Well, and they were gigantic, but, I mean, it made them look even bigger.
Yeah, well, speaking of Mike Jackson, I'm getting all these memories from Georgia. Mike Jackson, he was, you know, pretty much a prelim wrestler, job guy, made everyone look good. But Gordon Solie used to put him over – so much, like, more than all the other prelim guys. I mean, he really put him over. It was like, why did he do that?
Because he was really good. I mean, Mike Jackson was a great worker. You know, I mean, not even good. He was great, and that was the deal. You know, it's like some of those other job guys they had, they were job guys. But Mike Jackson, I mean, the problem with Mike Jackson was he came at a time when a guy his size could really only be a job guy. So he was a job – you know, he jobbed for – you know, Florida, Alabama, everywhere. You know, I mean, he was the best job guy in the Southeast, and so he did a lot of TV work. But you know, and Gordon tried to keep him strong because he was so good.
Yeah, yeah.
They would call him with the Alabama Junior Heavyweight Champion always.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember like seeing so many guys for the first, like, this thing's popping in my head like right now. Do you remember the angle where Kabuki? They had the angle where you got to attack Kabuki with his Kindle stick, and you'd get, like, the prize if you could actually hit him, but...
I do remember that.
I just remember, like, they would do it with all the job guys, and none of them would come close. He'd block them all, and then they brought in a young Tommy Rogers from the Fantastics, and he swung a few times, and Kabuki blocked it, but then Kabuki turned his back, and Tommy Rogers hit him across the back, and I just remember marking out so much as a little kid for that angle.
Mm-hmm.
So, Georgia used to have, like, a, I mean, that's what got me hooked on wrestling was Georgia and Tommy Rich. And just the other week, you answered some questions about Tommy Rich. And, I wanted to ask you, Tommy Rich, the Mad Dog plus Sawyer, they were, like, basically the top face and the top heel almost for, like, at least a year, maybe two. They went everywhere. They came here to San Antonio for a match one time. And they were, like, the top. And then as soon as that feud died, within, like, a year or two, they were, they just had dropped down so much. It's like, why do you think that happened?
I think, in the case of Buzz Sawyer had a lot of issues. I think that's really what it was. And Tommy did, I think Tommy Rich did as well. I think that they were, I don't know if promoters considered them unreliable or that they – Tommy lost his appeal. I just remember that watching Tom. Tommy Rich for a couple year period as this, humble, really good looking guy with a bleach blonde hair that the girls liked, was very over, but it just kind of faded. The looks kind of faded because he, drank and got heavy and things like that. And with Buzz was a maniac, but Buzz destroyed his body and then, got so heavily into the drugs that, he really, I think that people were afraid to, I think he just destroyed his body is what the answer is. I mean, Buzz just did crazy, crazy things. I remember his knees were shot real quick and he was limping around all the time and,
His breathing was really weird.
Yeah, I mean, he got fat, he got that big belly. I mean, he used to have that great physique and then he had the big belly and, yeah, I mean, who knows what he was doing, I mean, he was doing everything. I mean, I heard, the stories, I mean, he also got, he was, that's when the Road Warriors came in. And actually, the Road Warriors, it was really tough when you had the Road Warriors there because, the Road Warriors didn't sell much for Tommy Rich. And that kind of, he was going to go down anyway because he just didn't have the appeal. But that hurt him because it was like this main event babyface who the heels weren't selling for is kind of a killer spot. It's the people lose faith in you as a top guy. And Buzz Sawyer and Brett Sawyer wrestled the Road Warriors all the time. And the Road Warriors and Brett Sawyer got along, but Buzz was always trying to be tough guy, and they were trying to be tough guy. And so it didn't really mix that well, and the Road Warriors became bigger stars than Buzz Sawyer. So it was kind of, Buzz went to other places, but, yeah, no, he never – I don't know. I think part of it was Ole loved Buzz Sawyer, Ole Anderson, and any other promoters never saw Buzz's top talent. I mean, I would talk to other promoters, and it was, they felt he was too short, So and he had the drug problem. So it was all those things. Watts pushed him a little bit for a while. I remember when I think it was Dick Slater and Buzz Sawyer were kind of like the top heels in Louisiana, and Buzz Sawyer did the big angle with Jim Duggan with Deborah, that was which actually was a pretty big deal. I think that was maybe Buzz Sawyer's other big feud after Tommy Rich was the Jim Duggan feud a few years later. But after that, not so much.
Yeah, I think Tommy's main problem was he just didn't keep up body wise. All the jacked up guys came in were
yeah, that's what it was. It became a steroid thing, and a guy like Tommy Rich, physically people didn't buy him against those guys, whereas a couple of years earlier when you didn't have so many of those guys, Tommy had his role. That role kind of disappeared. Tommy got old. I always thought when Tommy Rich was on top that he wasn't going to be a big star at 30. I thought that, as soon as those, he had a certain thing to him.
Once he lost his baby face looks, that was kind of the end for him.
Yeah, because he really wasn't a great worker. I mean, he worked fast, and he knew what he was doing. He was definitely a smart worker and he was a good worker, but not in a spectacular way. But when he lost his looks, he just really didn't have anything but the name. And years later, I mean, Tommy Rich was around forever and ever, and aside from Tennessee, never really got that much of a push.
Yeah, it was actually hard for me to watch him at times because it's like I remember when I was a kid, he was such a big star, and then when he's jobbing to everybody on WCW, it's like it was just hard to watch it,
Yeah, that hurt too because people, people did remember him as a top guy, and it was like he was like in a sense he was like a washed up guy, and that hurt too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'll go ahead and segue to somewhere else. Something that we've always, me and my co-host, one of my co-hosts, have always wanted to ask you this when you were on in the past, but we always forgot. But why did Bob Backlund's title reign win, like, worst promotional thing in the Observer Awards?
Because people were sick of it. That's probably the best way to put it.
Oh, okay.
It was time for a change. I think Snuka, you know, realistically, I think that when Snuka came along, that people wanted Snuka to win so bad I mean, even then, I remember people wanting Morocco to win because Morocco was actually like a really, you know, he kind of had that championship thing around about him, but you know, it just wasn't going to happen. But Snuka got so popular. And Backlund also by 82 lost a lot of popularity with kids. So it was just one of those things where it was time to make the change. And, you know, they just weren't ready for the change. I mean, Vince owned it. You know, Vince Jr. bought it in 82 and he kept Bob as champion. I mean, Vince Sr.'s champion and he didn't, you know, it wasn't until they got Hogan that they wanted to make the switch. I guess business was good enough. And maybe they didn't trust Snuka and Bob was a good representative. I don't know the answer as to why they kept it on him, you know, that long. I mean, there was a, you know, at first Bob did very well as champion, but at the end it wasn't so good. But, you know, their company was still doing well. And then, and he was, you know, and I guess he was established as a champion by then after all those years on top. But he's another one where as soon as he lost that title, I mean, he, you know, some guys are, you know, former world champions. And, you know, like a Harley Race or Flair or whatever. And when they lost, they were, you know, they were superstars for the rest of their lives. Whereas Bob, you know, he lost. And within, you know, 6-9 months, you know, he was pretty much almost out of the business. It was just one of those things where it's like the title propped him up with something that he really didn't have. But it was the right place at the right time. And that title was so important. I don't know the exact answer, but, you know, and a lot of people get mad about it. But that's the facts of life is that, you know, after Bob was not a guy who, after he held the title, that anyone cared about. I mean, you know, Byrne tried to push him, and it, you know, completely didn't work. You know, but it, you know, I mean, he came back and had the run with, you know, he had that run years later as a heel. That, you know, he got a ton of heat, you know, for that brief period. But he was kind of older by that point. But yeah, and that's just what happened.
Yeah, I remember I was actually at the show where he beat Brett. Where Owen had him.
Oh, in the San Antonio match, yeah.
Yeah. And speaking of Jimmy Snuka, he's also making news today because apparently they are reopening his case. And I don't know how much you know about it, but do you think that there's a chance that they might actually charge him this time?
I couldn't even, you know, it's so long ago. I just don't know what you do. You know what I mean? I mean,
yeah.
Like, you know, there's, I don't know. I can't say because I don't know the evidence. You know, whatever's going to happen is going to happen. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was actually kind of surprised. I mean, because it's got to have been, what, close to 30 years?
Exactly 30 years. That's why, that's how the subject all came up, was the 30-year anniversary of her death. That's where it came back.
Wasn't that also the night that Eddie Gilbert had the car accident?
God, wasn't it like the day before or the day after? It was right
I remember seeing a shoot interview where he was saying that he went to the hospital and she was there. And
maybe. Yeah. Yeah, it was right around the same time.
Okay. Yeah, he was like, I think he said something like to the effect that they don't think the person's going to make it or something. He kind of thought they were talking about him, but they were actually talking about her. And
really? Oh, I never heard that.
Yeah, it was one of the shoot interviews that I think Bob Barnett did it, and they're just in a hotel room.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually a very fascinating shoot interview. I just don't know how much is, you know, true and how much isn't.
Mm-hmm.
But he actually talks about you, Dave. He talks. He thanked you actually. He thanked you because he said you were the only person who told the truth about what happened with Doug in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not even sure what he was talking. Just something with FNW. And he said that you told the true story, and he was you know, he thanked you for it.
Okay.
But do you remember what the story was?
Doug did a lot of things. I don't know what specific. I remember there was one thing, and I don't think it was FMW, but I think it was Wing. But it was one of the smaller promotions when Doug was there, and I think Eddie was there. And they were under gimmicks, and they took their gimmicks off, and they said that, you know, we pledge allegiance to All Japan. I think maybe it was a way of getting into All Japan, because All Japan was like a hot promotion then. It was a really weird thing. I don't remember exactly.
Okay, yeah, I think
but it Doug, Doug did one of those, you know, Halloween gimmick things there for years.
Yeah, that's what Eddie said, that they were, that he was excited because he was going to get to do a monster character too.
Yeah.
But I also wanted to ask you about the Von Erichs, of course. Have you ever seen the footage of David in Florida?
I was in Florida when he was there.
Oh,
you
were.
I saw David. I saw David and Dory as a tag team. David Von Erich and Dory Funk Jr. as a tag team, and they were, David Von Erich was great. He got a lot of heat, and then I saw him when he was a babyface against Dory a couple months later. I thought he was really good. I mean, you know, it wasn't, you know, and again, it's like people when they talk about the Von Erichs, because this was before, this was like 81, I'm thinking, and I remember people going like, oh, the Von Erichs because of Fritz, blah blah blah, they're not really any good. And, you know, I didn't get a lot of tapes then. I don't think too many people had VCRs. But I went to Florida, and I saw David, and it was like, wait a minute. This guy's like, I don't care who his dad is. This guy's really good. I mean, he was, you know, he was like Dory Funk Jr.'s protege in Florida. And, but, you know, he had the long bleached blonde hair. Looked kind of ridiculous with the hair, I got to say. But he could get heat, and he knew what he was doing as a worker. He was a great heel. And as a babyface, he had great fire. And he was a legitimate star. I don't care what his name would have been. He was going to be a star no matter what, anywhere. The guy could have gotten over.
Yeah, the thing from Florida that I recently saw of him, and it was like the first time, was actually a show where he goes out, he beats a prelim guy. He goes outside, he starts taunting Jerry Briscoe, and then I think he demands a second match, and he goes and beats another jobber, and he keeps on taunting Briscoe like the whole match. And I was like, I thought it was really great. But what I really wanted to ask you, did you see when Terry was in Florida?
Yes, I did see that too. But he was only in for like one or two, like a TV, and just very little. Like David brought Terry in the one time. And I don't remember, like, Kerry was, looked, I just remember my thoughts was thinking, and this, you know, at this point, Kerry's like 21 years old. I thought Kerry was kind of lost. He had a great physique, but, you know, it wasn't like, when I saw him, I thought, God, the guy's got a great physique. You know, he had a very charismatic look about him, but that was all he had at the time. I mean, like, I just remember, that's all he had was he had a great look.
Yeah, what I saw of it is, like, he's there, he's doing, like, a... He's at the booth, and he's kind of doing a heel promo, which just blew my mind away seeing him do it. And it's one of those things where he's just so bad, but it was so captivating watching, you know, Terry Von Erich be a heel and talk so arrogantly and everything. And then I think he wrestled Sweet Brown Sugar is what I think I saw him wrestle.
Oh, Skip Young. Yeah, I mean, well, that was a good family friend anyway. But the thing, Kerry should have never been because David, you know, he could go in there, but Kerry Von Erich was a natural babyface. He would not have been very good as a heel. Whereas David, and I don't think Kevin would have been a good heel either. David, on the other hand, could be anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think, like, some people, they'll make fun of me when I say this, but to me, the best babyfaces the babyface that, you know, selling, to me, the best ones always were Ricky Steamboat, Rick Martel, I mean, not Rick Martel, Ricky Morton, Barry Windham, and Kerry Von Erich.
I don't know if I'd put Kerry Von Erich in that position. Kerry Von Erich was what I thought. I mean, Kerry Von Erich was just so charismatic, more than any of those guys, even more than Steamboat. And, I mean, Morton was very charismatic, too. Barry Windham was missing some charisma. I mean, I'm not saying he wasn't charismatic, but he wasn't quite at the level of Steamboat or Ricky Morton as far as charisma. Now, as far as pure working ability, Barry Windham in his prime was as good as anybody. I mean, he was, you know, for a big, you know, 6'6" guy, I mean, he was really just a great, great worker till all the injuries started catching up to him, you know, and his, you know, other habits and getting heavy and all that other stuff. But, I mean, when he was, you know, Barry Windham in, like, what is it, mid to late 80s was fantastic. But he didn't have that super charisma to me. I mean, he was just he was just below that thing, but his work was so good that he could, you know, again, his matches with like Ric Flair were as good as anything was in that day, and with anyone, you know. I mean, it wasn't just Ric Flair, but I thought that he didn't have that killer charisma that even like him and Magnum TA were always like kind of put in the same stratus, you know, that guy who would challenge for the world title, and he would be they would be like the number the pretty boy other baby face with Dusty being the kick ass baby face. And I thought, you know, Barry was a much, much better wrestler than Magnum TA, but I thought Magnum TA, actually, people remember him better because Magnum TA was a better promo and
better
more charisma.
Yeah. Well, the reason I put Terry Von Erich up there is, even though he's below the work rate of the guys, is because of his size. I mean, I don't think I've ever remember seeing a guy the size of Terry Von Erich who could get such, you know, sympathy when he's getting pounded on. I mean,
well, actually, people naturally liked him, especially in Dallas where they saw him grow up. They were all, you know, that was a very unique thing anyway, with the kids of Fritz and everything, and just the way, you know, he had promoted that whole thing around them. But Kerry just had, you know, because you could say the same thing almost, you know, about Hogan, in the sense that when Hogan sold, I mean, you know, people would react, and it wasn't that Hogan was such a great worker, it's just that Hogan had so darn much charisma that people were into everything he did. And I think Kerry was like that. I think that those two guys in that era were the two most charismatic guys in there, you know, as far as baby faces went. And, you know, if you look at, you know, the, I mean, they're up there with others. I mean, I mean, The Rock probably surpassed Kerry. Obviously, he did as far as being a draw and things like that. But but aside from, you know, a guy at that level or Stone Cold, I mean, Kerry probably wouldn't be that far behind any of the other ones.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, I grew up here in San Antonio. They came here once a month at least, and I grew up through that whole period. And even now, knowing, you know, I don't see Kerry through the kid eyes anymore. I've learned the truth. I know things and so. But it's still like, I still have that hometown mentality where it's like, I think Kerry should be in the Hall of Fame. I mean, it was a short career.
Yeah. I mean, I thought about that, and he's been on the ballot. And the problem is that if you really think about it, it's
only like two or three years, unfortunately.
Yeah. I mean, like the, if you know, the Kerry Von Erich of 83, 84 and 85, should he be in the Hall of Fame? Yeah. But it's only those 3 years. And most of the guys that get in the Hall of Fame, there are exceptions, but not many, but most of the guys that get in the Hall of Fame, you know, are 10, 15 year, 20 year careers. And I mean, Kerry after, you know, even in 86, I mean, he was around from 86 until he passed away in 93, but those years he wasn't a Hall of Fame guy anymore. You know, he was very limited. The drugs had really gotten to him. He just wasn't that, you know, he didn't really draw anymore, you know, partially just the things that worked out in the area wasn't as strong. But I just think, yeah, it's like for those 3 years, Kerry Von Erich's an absolute Hall of Famer. But it's like Barry Windham is another one in that same realm. It's like Barry Windham from the Barry Windham from 85 to 90, you know, you could say, you know, was a Hall of Famer. But if you're going through his whole career from 90 on, I mean, he wrestled for years and years and years after that and really wasn't even that big of a star. You know, like in the WWF, like, they never really pushed him that hard, and he never really got – and it wasn't like he was this guy who got over above his push where you go like – you know, like some guys in WWF where you'll go like he was really over, but they just wouldn't give him a break. I mean, he didn't even get over like that. He was just – you know, he was just a guy on the roster for years and years. And so it's like – to me, you know, if you're a Hall of Famer, I mean, there's – I mean, like, again, there's always exceptions to every rule of guys that, you know, you can point out and just go like, well, this guy, you know, whatever. But, I mean, like, that's kind of like my thought as far as Kerry is just like not – it just wasn't enough years.
Yeah, yeah. I want to go ahead and segue to another subject here. I once tried to do a show on the All Japan Women's. My co-host didn't cooperate and they didn't watch too many matches, so it was kind of hard to do. But I wanted to ask you a few questions about that era because I saw some of it not too long ago. I fell in love with it. You know, and I want to start off with, I don't even know how to say her name, Manami Toyota?
Manami Toyota, yeah.
Yes. Okay, there's, you can argue that she may be the greatest women's wrestler of all time, but I want to take that a step further. If you added her with the men, where would she be at the best of all time? Because I think she'd be ranked pretty high. I mean, I think she's phenomenal.
Yeah. I thought when she was around in her prime, I thought that she was the best man or woman. I mean, she had the best matches, right? You know, in the early 90s.
Oh, yes. Like the three tag team matches of Kensai.
Yeah, Dynamite Kensai and Miyumi Ozaki against Toyota and Yamada.
Yeah.
Those matches were great. I saw the Toyota Yamada hair match, which I was at live. I mean, that's still the best live wrestling match I've ever seen. I mean, it was better than Saruta and Misawa, better than Flair and Steamboat. So, that match, you know, just the emotion in the crowd and everything like that. She was, you know, I remember people telling me, it's, oh, you know, she's cold and she doesn't connect. And it's just like, how come every time I saw her, the crowd went crazy every time? When she first started, I saw her when she was probably 19 years old, when I was over there and she was first breaking through. And she was on men's cards, and she tore it up. And, like, she, you know, she had that young, pretty girl thing going for her, but her work was so good, and she got over, like, huge. It didn't matter the audience. It wasn't like, you know, oh, it's only little girls liked her. I mean, she got over in her out of her promotion just as good as in her promotion. And she's as a worker. You know, she had a 20-year career, and I guess she still wrestles from time to time.
I know she's done a couple of Shikara shows
Shikara shows, and I see her name on some big shows in Japan and when they have big women shows and stuff and they bring her back. So she's still around. I mean, she would be, what would she be? I'm thinking if she was born in the early, in maybe 71, so she's like 42.
She's my age then.
Yeah.
I think the first match I ever saw of any All Japan women's was a hair match. And the thing is about that match, people say she doesn't have that much rhythm or whatever. The match is great. I mean, the match is 5 stars. What happened after the match is even better.
Oh,
I mean,
everybody's crying, and oh, that was unbelievable. But I had no idea
what the story was, but I was emotional watching it. It was like, wow, it's so dramatic.
Well, the deal was is because there was a lot of heat there, because it was two baby faces who were tag team partners, and they did one singles match a month earlier that was just as good. I thought when I saw on tape. And it was like, holy Toledo, this match is fantastic. And then I was in Japan when they did the hair match. I remember the story, and it was funny because Sean Waltman was there, and you know we were going to go. I think that we were at we were together, and then we were going to go to the thing, and then the guys, you know, talked Sean out of you don't want to go to that and all this. And they were kind of talking to me about, yeah, you don't want to go. And I'd been before. So to me, it was just like, I've been to All Japan Women. I'm not missing an All Japan Women show. There's no way. And he got talked out of going, and I remember I saw him, like, it was a noon show. So the match probably took place around 2, 2.30. We were out of there by 3. I probably saw him at 5. And it was like, what happened? I go, oh, it was only the best match I've ever seen in my life. And he was, like, so mad he missed it about, like, these guys talking him out of it or whatever the thing was, why he didn't go. And I was like, seriously, it was, like, the best match I ever. And it is still to this day as far as alive pro wrestling match. It is the best match that I ever saw live.
And the match that I think that's even better is her 60-minute match with Inoue.
Yoko Inoue. That match, I mean, when that match happened, a couple people who were at the match, like, I don't remember if they called me, because this was 95-ish, so it wouldn't have been before email. So it must have been a phone call or maybe a fax, I don't even know. But I just remember, like, when that was also an afternoon match. And I had heard, and it was just like, this was the greatest match of all time. You have to see it. And, you know, and I don't know when I actually saw it. It was probably a month later or something. And I mean, yeah, you know, it was exhausting because it wasn't like your typical, again, this is what I, you know, it's like your typical 60-minute match is this match that builds, and there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, when it's done right, it's great. But it
In the first minute, there was a power slam from the top rope to the floor.
I mean, they were just out there, like, running. Like, they were, like, sprinting for 60 minutes, and it was like, You know, it's almost like when you say that, it's like, this shouldn't work. In fact, I'm watching it going like, this makes no sense. How can you do a match like that? But it did work. You know, it's like you would go like, nobody can keep up a pace like this. The fan, you know, and even if you can athletically, the fans can't. But in that case, they did. And it's like, and how can you do that kind of match without repeating moves? And they did repeat moves. You know, they did do the same moves over and over. But whatever, it still worked. I mean, that was the key is that it worked. I mean, because there's things I could pick apart about that match. But when it was over, yeah, I mean, it won. I think it won Match of the Year, too. And I remember seeing it, and it was, you know, at the time, it was like, everybody was raving like the greatest 60-minute match of all time, and maybe it was and maybe it wasn't, but, I mean, it's definitely one of the 60-minute matches I've seen. It's very, you know, I've never seen a 60-minute match at that pace, I don't think.
Yeah, when I watched it, I watched it on YouTube. I knew it was 60 minutes. I knew it was in six parts, and I was jumping out of my seat for false finishes in the third part.
Yeah.
You know, so, I mean, yeah, it was fantastic. I mean, I think I love watching her wrestle. I mean, I could watch her all day. And another All Japan's Women question I wanted to ask you is I watched the Bull Nakano Asia Kong cage match.
Oh, yeah.
Which was crazy. They were using scissors and
wasn't that is that the one where the finish is the leg drop off the cage?
Yeah, and she's barefoot, too.
Yeah, right. That was, yeah, that's probably why Bull Nakano had such a bad back for so many years, was doing moves like that.
Yeah, but what I wanted to ask you, though, about the match is they both had seconds who were having a hell of a brawl on their own outside, and Bull Nakano's second was an American, and she was blonde, and I was wondering, because I couldn't really tell, it wasn't the greatest picture, but was that Medusa?
Might have been. I mean, the era sounds right, because Medusa and Asha Kong feuded, And Medusa was there then, and Bull, I mean, I don't remember the seconds, but I'm guessing for Asha Kong it might have been Bison Kimura, because Asha Kong and Bison Kimura were like the Jungle Jacks. They were like the big tag team,
uh-huh.
The big heel tag team at the time, and they were very charismatic too. That as a team, they were, you know, a great heel team as far as getting over and you know, worked great with the baby faces and everything. I like them. They were, you know, because Bison Kimura was never pushed as the, you know, she was kind of like the Arn Anderson of the women, in the sense she was never pushed on top as a single, but she was a great, great worker. And Asha Kong, you know, was the great monster heel. She really was. She was, and if you watch back at, and I remember seeing them, you know, I saw Asha Kong for years, and that era, you know, like she had that invincible heel thing going for her, and great fighter, and when the baby faces would finally beat her, it was like something, because they, you know, usually she'd like use that spinning back fist on them and killed them. And she walked in the building and like the place would just go crazy. And the funny thing about her is she appeared to be this monster in the ring. And I mean, she probably was over 200 pounds, but she's really short. And I mean, that's what the thing I think was so funny. It was so much of it was illusion, in the sense you think she's this giant monster. And she was, and Dump Matsumoto was the same way. She was probably 5'4". You know, you think of this giant, these giant monsters, but they really were not that big. But in the ring, they looked like they were 6 feet tall and 260-pound men, you know?
Yeah. My favorite spot that she would do in the matches that I watched were like, it would be a tag match where she would basically have like a Boston Crab or a hold like that, and the babyface partner would come in and kick her, and she would no-sell it, and she'd kick her again, and she'd no-sell it. And she'd kick her again, and she'd cinch in the Boston Crab even tighter. I mean, it was just—I would just mark out every time for that. It was just a great spot.
Mm.
Yeah. And excuse me. Also, like regarding Japan, one of our listeners wants you to talk about what you think of Prince Devitt. And I know he's. I was watching the iPay-per-view, and I got to that match. I haven't seen it yet. I know it's pretty good. And my question about Prince Devitt is he's doing a great job now, but would he be taken seriously if they actually gave him the main title?
It'd be hard. I don't know that he's going to get the main title. Although, you know, maybe he will, because they're really wanting to build a lot around him. But it's not, I mean, like, you know, again, you know, there's history of what everyone will do, but in, you know, times have changed, and everything changed. Everything's different. So, like, a guy like Prince Devitt could have never gotten it, you know, a few years ago. But now, I don't know. I think he could. I think he could.
I mean, he's having great matches with Tanahashi, and, you know, Tanahashi was, you know, a great champion. I'm kind of curious to see how, like, they match up size-wise. That's if, like, if they haven't seen a match yet.
I mean, it's not too bad. It's not too bad. Like, it's like when they're in there, it's not like it's a big guy against a small guy. There isn't that big of a size difference. It looks great. It just looks like there's a lot of interference in the match, so it's almost like it in a way, like, they can have a much better match than the one they had. That was probably the right match to have, given where they're going right now, and that Devitt has to win, and that they didn't want to beat Tanahashi clean, and so they put the odds against him, and, you know, like that. But I think that, like, if I would like to see them be put in a position to have, you know, the 30-minute championship match, I think that they could have a match of the year if they were put in, if one or the other had the title and defended it in a straight match. And, you know, honestly, I think that probably actually be a pretty cool story to have Tanahashi beat Devitt for the chance, have Devitt win the title and Tanahashi win it from him, you know, maybe at you know, down the line. I mean, I don't think that will happen, but I just think that as far as, like, Tanahashi is the challenger and Devitt is, like, this, you're a pure heel champion who's, you know, so good. I mean, it's I think that dynamic is awesome.
Yeah, that's a good idea. What I was kind of thinking was that if he ever did win the title, I thought it would maybe be accepted more if he beat Tanahashi than Okada, because then there would be the size difference.
Okada's bigger than Tanahashi, though.
That's what I mean. Like, Okada, like, it would be better for him to beat. It would be more believable for Devitt to beat Tanahashi.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. I think. The thing is that no matter if Devitt wins the title, my thought is that he should keep it for, you know, 4 to 6 months, preferably 6 months, and go through four or five guys and not lose it the first time out and build to the Tanahashi match like it's a real big one. And then maybe that would be the right guy for him to lose it to. Or he could lose it to Okada again. But then it's like you're going back to the guy. I mean, you could do that too. And, I mean, it's a little early, and I just don't know that they would beat Okada in April. I mean, we're talking about in July. It feels too early to beat Okada. I'd like to see Okada get two or three more wins. Maybe go through. You know, I mean, I guess you kind of feel like you should go through until January, and then maybe in January have somebody beat him, but I just don't want to go with the January to be Tanahashi Okada at the Tokyo Dome. I mean, I know it's the easy one to go with, but it's just they did it last year and they've done the singles match so many times and they'll do it many times before, you know, many more times. But I just don't think the Tokyo Dome is the place I'd like to see. You know, I that's why I almost think that, like, maybe Devitt winning and building a Devitt Tanahashi or something, or maybe. I don't know. I don't know about Nakamura. I mean, Okada Nakamura to me is a match that I'd like to see at some point. It's early for it now, but I would love to see that match as well. And that obviously is going to be a feud down the line when they finally split them up.
Mm-hmm. Now, and another guy that I really love from New Japan is Minoru Suzuki.
Yeah, I love Minoru Suzuki. He's my favorite guy almost to watch in the sense of. Because he's different. I wouldn't say he's not the best guy, but I even tweeted this. I go, like, if you're a young wrestler, he's a guy I would study because he does things so different from everybody else, and there's probably stuff you could pick up, especially if your mentality is to do if you're an MMA guy or a amateur wrestler guy, you know, who's kind of coming in and wanting to do a realistic. You know, it's pro wrestling style, but more of a realistic pro wrestling style. I think you can pick up so many spots from him. You know, and I know King Mo has been studying him. You know, and that's not from me. He got that from, you know, I don't even know who he got it from. I just know that one time he just texted me and just was talking about how he's been studying Minoru Suzuki matches, and I thought, that's funny. I would probably suggest that.
Yeah, yeah. Speaking of, like, the shoot style, Because I don't know too much about the history of those shoot or work shoot promotions in Japan. Was he an actual? Did he actually do shoots or was?
Oh yeah. He was the original when Pancras went. It was him, Funaki Suzuki and Ken Shamrock, who were the three big stars. And then they were the three best shooters when the thing first started, because they were the ones with most, you know, the most experience and the most training in it. And as time went on, you know, guys caught up to those three. You know, Ken ended up leaving, but guys, you know, the way that they trained and everything, and the way that they fought monthly or every 6 weeks, they made a lot of mistakes because nobody knew what the hell was going on. It was they were like pioneers of something new, so they all hurt each other, and they, you know, as shooters. Their primes were relatively short. I mean, Suzuki lost a lot of matches, and he was knocked out. He had, you know, I'm guessing that he's had a million concussions, which is amazing because, you know, he does that style now, and he's 45 years old, and he's awesome at it. But that's one of the reasons that his style works, is because they know the choke is real because he beat people with the choke. They know the armbar is real because he beat people with the armbar. They know he's, you know, he was a great shooter in his day, and in pro wrestling, you know, you can – keep living that day, you know, for a lot longer than you can in like, you know, like, it's like if somebody like Nogueira 3 years ago just turned to pro wrestling, I mean, he could be Nogueira for another 10 years, but in MMA, he, you know, or Randy Couture or something, you know, you can be that guy in pro wrestling because if the people believe you, you know, whereas in, you know, in a real shoot, at a certain point, you know, your time runs out, and it's not very forgiving when that time happens. You really need to get out of it. I mean, Suzuki stayed too long. He was getting knocked out a lot at the end. But people don't remember that. People remember, you know, the early, because his early matches were much higher profile, and he won a lot of those.
Yeah. I remember having Paul Lazenby on the show, and I think he was talking about a match. I think he was talking about he was doing some training with Suzuki, and that.
Well, he would. I don't know if he wrestled Suzuki, but he was. Paul Lazenby was from that era. I mean, he was that original Pancras era of guys that were, you know, learning what it was. I mean, nobody really knew. You know, it's like the early UFC guys. Nobody knew what it was. Everyone's learning on the fly. So Paul was from that era.
Yeah, he told me that Suzuki would beat the shit out of him, but he did it in a way where he was actually teaching him. You know, and Paul like speaks the world of Suzuki.
Yeah, he had a lot of tricks, and he was another one. I mean, it's funny because when they were in Pancras, you know, I mean, Funaki was the one everyone knew, because when Funaki when Funaki and Suzuki were pro wrestlers before they quit New Japan, I don't remember much about Suzuki. I mean, Suzuki got fanfare when he started because he was a college wrestling star. And Funaki didn't, because Funaki started when he was 15 years old, and he was, you know, high school dropout. But Funaki in camp was just so great. And when he started, you know, I mean, I remember Funaki at 15 and 16 seeing him in prelims, and it was just like, my God, this guy's great. He's going to be the greatest of all time. And then he left. He quit New Japan. He went and he did shoot style, and he had a good career shoot style. But then when he finally came back to pro wrestling, you know, a couple of years ago. I mean, he really is, he's a star because of, because he's Funaki, and he's had a name for years and years, but I never saw, like on this run with Funaki, I mean, it's like, I watch, you know, I mean, it's like, he's Funaki, he's a legend, and they keep him strong, and they don't abuse him, and so, he's all right, but Suzuki, you know, who I never remember, you know, in those days being blown away as a pro wrestler, now I'm blown away, you know, like he's 45 years old, and I just think the world of him as a pro wrestler.
Yeah, that's Funaki. Did he fight Roberto Duran one time?
Yeah, that was a work.
That was a work. Okay, because I saw that and it was really weird. I was like, I couldn't tell what was going on.
Yeah, Duran came in really out of shape, and it was just a bad match.
Yeah, it was pretty bad. I was actually laughing through most of it. It was so weird. But you had mentioned that, going back to the women, you mentioned that some of the women were having shoots on the show.
Oh, on the All Japan Women, they would have, I mean, when I went in the...
Were they wearing gloves when they would have the shoots?
Yeah, I
remember a match with Bat, I can't remember her name.
Bat Yoshinaga was one of the best shooters they had.
Yeah, and on one of the Dream shows, she has, like, a kickboxing match with an American, and... I always was wondering, like, it was just so, it seemed so out of place. I was wondering, you know, I didn't
it was out of place when I would see it. They would do it at Corcoran Hall. They would have one shoot match. It was like the, I think they had like the martial arts championship is what they had. And I don't think it was on every Corcoran Hall show, and they never did it on the spot shows. I could be wrong about this, is how I remember it, but I don't remember if they did it at every Corcoran show. I think maybe it wasn't, because I didn't see many of them, but you could tell immediately they were shoots, and I thought they were out of place too. I never liked the shoots on a pro wrestling show because they were never as good as the pro wrestling matches. And then when you would do a MMA show or a real show and you do a pro wrestling match, I generally didn't like that either, because the pro wrestling, when you've seen a bunch of shoots, when they start doing the pro wrestling, people see through it. But, you know, there have been exceptions, because when they did that Tokyo Dome show a couple years ago, not Tokyo Dome, but the New Year's Eve, where Josh Barnett and Shibata and those guys were doing the pro wrestling. I mean, the pro wrestling actually stole, you know, it was almost all shoots, and they did maybe three pro wrestling matches. And actually, I thought the pro wrestling matches were better than all the shoots, you know, and the public reacted to it. So, and I remember on that one, it was like, God, you can't do it on the, you know, they're both great, but you don't do it on the same show. But on that one, it, you know, you never know. On that show, the pro wrestling matches worked on the shoot show.
Yeah, I actually got to see, I didn't see the whole show because it was so long, but I remember getting home in time to watch, for sure, the tag match. I saw a little bit of the Barnett match, but it was like, yeah, those matches were great. They blew away all the other stuff that I saw from that show.
Yeah, you know, the funniest part, too, is the announcing was just great. And I know Mike Kogan a little bit, and he hates pro wrestling, and he was great. And I was thinking, like, this is the worst guy to announce. I mean, he just despises pro wrestling. Maybe he got an appreciation for it, and then I don't know. But it wasn't that much longer before that where he would, you know, because he was always like, oh, God, you're talking about pro wrestling again. Because he lives in, he's a San Jose guy. But, you know, Chabello, of course, who's the other announcer, is a giant pro wrestling fan. I wish that, honest to God, if I could have done this, I would, you know, if the timing would have worked out, I would have loved for them to have, you know, like an HD net in the 90s and have Michael Chiavello out there based in Japan calling, you know, a Michael Chiavello out there calling the All Japan and the New Japan big shows on TV. It would have been like that would have been, you know, in English, it would have been the greatest thing in the world when they had all those great matches, but the timing never worked out, you know, by the time, you know, I mean, and again, we've never really had the Japanese pro wrestling on TV.
Yeah.
Here for any length of time. I don't even remember. I mean, we had the pay-per-views of the UWFI, and we had the pay-per-views of Pancras that I remember. All Japan Women were on TV here at different times. They were on FNN, Financial News Network, in the Chigusa era, so that's the 80s. And then the Fuji Network, I remember when the Fuji Network was on cable here in San Francisco, because I watched All Japan Women on TV before the Crush Girls era, because I remember watching, you know, Mimi Hagiwara and Jumbo Horii, and this was before the women were that good. Although they were a lot better than the women here, because I just remember watching going, God, they're so much better than the American women. But they weren't. I didn't think that they were like better than the American men. Whereas, you know, when I watched the Crush Girls era and I was watching this stuff, it was like, you know, these women are better than the men. And it was funny too, because the men that went to Japan, you'd have the two polar opposite views. You'd have some men who would just go out there and say they're better than we are, and then other men who would just go, the idea of 130-pound women doing pro wrestling and, you know, as being taken seriously as a joke, you know, because
yeah.
They came from that, you know, pro wrestlers should be 200, and, you know, big, tough guys, and these were women. And, you know, the idea that In the mid-80s, you know, the Crush Girls were actually the Crush Gals is what they were called. But anyway, they were mainstream stars, you know, and they were in many ways bigger than the male stars.
Were they actually singers? Or?
I mean, they had songs that sold tons of records. They weren't good singers, but yeah, like, it was one of those things where they were just so over that that for a year or two, you know, their records sold. You know, I don't know who to compare them to. You know, here, I mean, like, it's some, you know, when somebody who's like not really a rock star, but they're
like maybe like a Hillary Duff or like one of the Disney girls.
Yeah, yeah, like the Disney girls. That's what they would be. When Hillary Duff, I think, is a pretty good comparison. Same kind of age group. You know, Britney Spears early. Not now, but the 16-year-old version.
Yeah.
They were like that. I mean, they were, you know, they had songs that were top 10 songs, you know, and I remember, and I saw them sing, and I mean, it was crazy watching them sing. I'll say that. I mean, it wasn't like they were, like when I would watch them, it's not like they were really good singers or anything, but
they were just so over.
They were over like they were good singers. They commanded the audience like they were good singers, but it was like, you know, they were, I mean, their singing got more reaction than their wrestling at one point until,
wow,
you know, I'm talking about their peak. We were talking about like 84, 85, 86, you know, but it was a short peak, you know, really.
Okay. Now, I want to shoot over to the American women. You know, for years you've had your I cheered in with this Cerro Del Rey. You've had that core, but now you have it seems like there's a new group kind of coming up. And I want to throw out three names. You might not even know too much about them, but I've been watching I went to the Shimmer Show at WrestleMania. I've been watching some YouTube. And do you think that, do you think that Mia Yam, Santana Garnett, or Leva Bates would ever have a chance to get into the WWE?
I've only seen Santana on TNA, and I don't remember her ever. They never let her wrestle, so I've never seen her on indies. I've seen Mia Yim, and I don't know. I haven't seen enough for her. And Leva Bates, I don't know at all. So I'm not the right person to ask about that.
Okay, what I like about Leva Bates is she has this great gimmick. She is, I guess the word would be Colts player, where she basically every match she comes out as a different character. Like she'll come out as Iron Man. Or she came out as the bad character from Saw, or just real different. I mean, she's not bad in the ring. So I mean, I just don't know if she's pretty enough, you know, to get into WWE.
That sucks. I mean, like, because I think the Cerro Del Rey thing kind of like I was so down on that, you know, in the sense of, and I'm not saying that they're wrong, but you never know until you try. It's like there's no, like, I, you know, like, I've always thought, like, if somebody's really good, you don't close your mind to it. You put them out there, and you may be right. You know, it's like some people get over and some people don't. I thought Cerro Del Rey in WWE, you know, like I thought she would never get a chance, and she did never get a chance. But when I used to see her, I used to think if I was WWE, I would hire her because she's the antithesis of everyone else, so because of being different. She could stand out like Aja Kong did, or Aja Kong, Amazing Kong did.
Yeah.
But Amazing Kong, it didn't work out, and that was, you know, Kong's fault. It wasn't WWE's fault. But with Sarah, I would have loved to them just, you know, go in there and give her a chance to be that, you know, there's a character that she could play, and I think that she would get over, but it's not going to happen. You know,
she could have been like Victoria, but even more effective. You know, because Victoria was like a little bigger, and Sarah would be bigger than her.
Victoria was more traditionally pretty, but Sarah's not. She's like she's not unattractive, but she's not a model. But you don't have to. Everyone doesn't have to be a model. I mean,
They need to have some mean ugly girls, you know, for the pretty girls.
She's not even ugly. That's the thing.
Oh yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
But their thing is so skewed. I mean, they used Molly Holly and they tried to make fun of her looks, and you know, and I Molly Holly actually is like super super pretty if you're ever met her in person. And it's like they were using her as an ugly girl, you know. And it's like Jesus freaking Christ. It's like such a weird thing. And remember when Gail Kim was in WWE and they were making fun of her looks, and it's like Gail Kim is a really good looking woman, and it's like the thing is, so, and that's why I'm sure that they're thinking, oh, Cerro Del Rey, she's not pretty enough for you know, but it's like she's good looking in a very different way, and I'm not saying, you know, she could be a baby face too. I would start her as a heel. I think that in the long run, I think as a baby face, I think people would get behind her because again. You know, there's something about being someone like someone as opposed to being someone who is an unrealistic character. You know, I mean, like, unrealistic characters, no matter how good-looking they are, in a lot of ways, sometimes they get over it, but sometimes they don't. And sometimes it's like, you know, you look at, like, the man of the people thing, you know, and that's a very, you know, and again, a woman of the people character has never really been done, and that's something that you can do. You know, like the tough, just I'm tough and I'm good and I'm, you know, I'm not super pretty and I'm not, you know, whatever. But, you know, again, that character can work. And, you know, she didn't, but she, it's not going to happen with her, unfortunately. You know, I always think, you know, one of the things that whenever I hear about the recruiting and everything, and even more so, I mean, this goes back 15 years with WCW and WWF when they were looking for all those guys. And WCW had the power plant. And I kept thinking of, like, and WWF had Tough Enough, if you remember. And I was thinking, like, if you went through, like, historically, of the guys from the previous 25 years, if they were to be cast to try out for Tough Enough, okay, and that mindset that they had, they wouldn't even make the cut. And they drew more money than the biggest stars WWF was having at the time, with the exception of two or three people. But yeah. It's like, and I always thought, it's like, did they realize that, like, there's all shapes and sizes and you never know what's going to work until you give it a try? It's like that whole thing of, you know, all those years with Mick Foley, you know, where they wouldn't touch him because, it's like, but he got over in other places. And it's always been a pet peeve of mine, of that narrow-minded view that you have to be really good-looking and have a really good body to be a main event wrestler. Yeah, it helps, especially if you're charismatic. But, you know, like you know, a young Jerry Lawler or a Jackie Fargo or Ray Stevens or, you know, how many of those guys, you know what I mean? I mean, they couldn't get in the door now. And those guys drew more money than almost anyone, and they connected better than almost anyone. And, you know,
like we were talking about Tommy Rich, you know,
Tommy Rich now could never get out of developmental. He could never, let me take that back. He could never get in developmental.
Yeah.
He might be able to get in developmental because of the looks, but he would not get out of developmental.
Yeah. And another person who I think is because of the PG, is going to be kept out, who I think could actually make it in the WWE. It's a real good friend of mine. I'm really good friends with Trina Michaels, and it's like it kind of hurts me because I know she's good enough, but I know because of what she used to do in the past that
she's not going to get in. That's the reality. Yeah.
It's a shame she didn't come around to wrestling during the Attitude Era, because then she might have had a shot.
Maybe, but you know what? I mean, it still would have been tough.
I know that they did.
It's possible. Because I know that they used Jenna Jameson for a few skits, but then they got rid of her. But it still would have been tough. That's a tough image to. But yeah, they won't, and that's not gonna change.
Yeah. Now, Dave, I want to go back talk about the New Japan pay per view. But actually, what I want to ask is, what time are they showing it on Friday?
Which one?
Aren't they having an I Japan New pay per view on the 5th?
They got one on the 4th and the 5th. Yeah, the New Japan is, it's the same middle of the night time slot, yeah.
So would it be Thursday night or Friday night?
Late Thursday night at, 5 a.m. or 3 a.m. I haven't even looked because, you know, I don't even know if I'm going to be able to watch that because I'm going to be going to the convention and just that whole weekend I'm so booked up, and then I got to go home. And so I'm hoping I have time to watch it, but that one may be the one I miss. It'll probably be the only one I miss, but.
I was kind of hoping it was going to be Friday night. That way we could have just watched it at the sweet party.
Well, you know, we could watch it on tape delay. We don't got to watch it live. If you want to do that, and if you can hook it up to a TV, then I'll watch it for sure.
Oh, I'll bring one of those wires that attach to TV. Yeah, we could check it out.
Or we could watch, you know what else? We could watch the Dragon Gate too, because that one's July 4th, and I mean, no one's going to be. I can't imagine anyone watching. Maybe I'm wrong. I can't imagine watching a pay per view on July the 4th. I guess the Dragon Gate. I actually could wake up first thing July 4th, you know, and watch it because, you know, if I'm going to do stuff with my family, it's going to be that. You know, we'll do stuff at night. If I wake up early before everybody else, I can sit here for a few hours and then before they wake up and watch the whole pay-per-view. So I actually may watch Dragon Gate on the 4th, but that's not a for sure thing. But New Japan, I mean, the first thing on the 5th, I'm coming to Vegas, so I'm not going to be able to watch it on Friday morning. And then by the time I get home on Sunday, I just think the catch-up is going to be so difficult that I won't have time for a pay-per-view.
You're so busy working. I really wish you'd have more time to actually enjoy the convention a little more, like Brian's able to. But I know you're.
It's tough. I've got when I get there, I'm supposed to have a meeting with somebody from Fuel when I get there. And then at 2, I'm being interviewed for a documentary. This is on Friday.
Uh-huh.
And then by that time I'm done there, then it's weigh-ins and then the dinner and all that. So that'll be okay. And then Saturday I've got stuff all day too, right up until the show. And then we got the show all night. So it's like it's really, really tight schedule that weekend. It's crazy. I'm like, you know, it's good, but it's like if it wasn't for those two Japan pay-per-views, I would just think, it's cool. But with those two Japan pay-per-views that I really want to watch, it becomes very stressful of where am I going to get the time. And again, you know, Thursday night, the 4th, I got to figure out when to watch Impact because, I mean, I'm not watching Impact live on Thursday. That is not happening. So I got to figure out, you know, again, when I come back on Sunday, you know, watch Impact and then SmackDown. It's hard to keep up.
You know, last year we actually had a short conversation about our letter writing campaign to the UFC and their response to that. And because of what you told me, that this year, myself and Rodney and a few other people, we're not even going to the UFC show.
Well,
yeah.
It's like, well, he basically, not your words, but basically he said we could go fuck ourselves. So I'm telling Dana, you know, you can have your show, but I'm not contributing to it.
I didn't like the way that was done. I think that, you know, if it was me in that situation, I would have given free T-shirts or something. I'd have done something public relations, because there's a reality of, you know, it's like things happen and things get changed and it's part of business. But that card changed too much, and you know, and again, if it was all due to injuries, I guess in a way it was due to injuries because
that's the difference. It wasn't.
Yeah, but they pulled guys who were on the show to other shows and weakened the show when they were charging, you know, their WrestleMania prices. No, I didn't like the way they handled that at all. I was shocked. I was really shocked. I thought that, you know, I was shocked that they weren't more fan friendly, because you know the funny part is that you know, Dana's real fan friendly, but I think that they've still got this.
It's kind of like a gangster mentality.
I don't know what it is, but it is a thing of, look, we're giving you a show. You should be happy. We're giving you a show. Lots of people want to see our show. If you don't like our show, somebody else will take your tickets. You know, when you're always selling out breeds a certain thing. I mean, and it's not, they're not alone. I know other promoters, when you're always selling out, you don't have to be so fan-friendly because you're always selling out. It's when you are struggling, then you start being fan-friendly, and they're still not struggling. I mean, it's like, you know, it's a tough thing because I think that one of the things with them, and this is kind of how I see it with them, because, and you know, I know all those people. They have got where, for so long, they were criticized by people who were always wrong, always wrong. So when that happens, you start thinking all these people who criticize us are always wrong. But every now and then, sometimes those people are also right. But when they've been wrong, you know, they group their fans together. It's like that's the problem is these guys, you know, like Dane will go, these guys on the internet, these guys on Twitter, these reporters. And it's like the thing is like, yes, in all those categories, there's people who don't get it, there's people who don't know, and there's people who say stupid stuff, and there's, God knows, there's people who don't know the first thing about business. And you guys do know business, you know, no question. So what happens is you get this thing of every time you're criticized, because you know that they're wrong, and history has shown that they're wrong, that you just go, they're wrong, they're wrong, they're wrong, they're wrong, and you just get immune to the criticism.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, sometimes the criticism is right, and when the criticism is right, you're not, you know, and I think that's the only way I can kind of rationalize what happened there is, how many times have they been told, you know, oh, you know, this card's not worthy of pay-per-view, and then they've made millions of dollars on pay-per-view, and they've gotten a big number, or nobody wants to see this match, and then they go out there, you know, and do record numbers. And I mean, some of their biggest matches, I remember like when Rampage and Rashad did their match, and that was probably, to me, the Rampage Rashad match was the single greatest build up to a match in history, because you know they've had a few shows that did bigger, but not too many. But that was a non-title match with two guys that, you know, I guess they were kind of top. They were top contenders, but it wasn't like it was, you know, Brock Lesnar who was world champion. It was two guys who everything just clicked. And you know, I just remember, like, during this, this phony rivalry from TV. And then, you know, the match ended up being delayed. Oh, no one, you know, this was from last year. No one wants to see it now. And they went and they did that build-up, and it's just like, that phony pro wrestling build-up. And then they went in there and they did, you know, a million buys. And it's like, when you do that and people are telling you all along that nobody wants to see this, and then you get a number, you do business like that, you know, that's where you get that attitude of these people don't know what they're talking about. But the problem is there are people who know what they're talking about and there are people who don't, but they don't know the difference between those who do and those who don't. And they get so many people who complain. And because of that, they get you either go crazy or you get immune to it. And what happened is they got immune to it. But in this case, the complaints were valid. But I think that's what happened is it's just like, you know, we're going to have a sellout. We got a $7 million gate. And you know, got to remember, when that show happened, I mean, you know, they did a $7 million gate. So it's kind of like saying, well, all these people are complaining, we did a $7 million gate. So it's kind of like that's how you rationalize. I'm not saying they were right, but I that's kind of where you come from.
It's hard not to go when you spent $250 to $300 on a ticket, even if you're upset, you know?
Right. I know. They were absolutely wrong, and I was shocked at the way it was. Like I said, I was shocked at the way it was handled. I was stunned because I thought, I know those people, and I thought I knew how they would react. And I was on this, you know, and 9 times out of 10, I'd be right. This time was the time I was wrong.
And also, another thing I don't like is, okay, this year, you know, it's their big Super Bowl weekend thing, and the card, you know, is not the greatest card even before the change, and they went back to the inflated prices just for this show. And it's
that's a business mistake, and you're right about that. These prices were too high for this card. When I saw the numbers, and I mean, the problem was, I'll tell you what the big problem was on this one, and it's going to, you know, maybe I'll be wrong this time, but I don't think so, is in the business, Chris Weidman is so well respected, but the fans don't know who he is. And I think that their idea is that you know, this is Anderson Silva's greatest test. And it may very well be Anderson Silva's greatest test. You know, and certainly he's, you know, on paper, he's a much better test than Chael Sonnen was, who gave Anderson Silva, you know, a really tough fight once and a really tough first round once the other time. So in their mind, it's like it's Anderson Silva against a better opponent. And he is, but, I mean, I know just from – the public has not been convinced of Chris Weidman. They don't know him. They're not convinced of him. And so they went in there with this idea of, you know, it's a bigger fight than last year's fight. Because in their mind, it's I don't think they expected to do the business last year's fight did, but in their mind, it's Anderson Silva, and it's July 4th weekend, and we did $7 million last year, and we got the Fan Expo, so we're going to have, you know, 35,000 people coming to town for the Expo, so we'll be able to sell the tickets at the high prices. And it's I don't know what the deal is. I mean, they have tickets sold. I don't know, you know, I mean, I know what they have at the box office, but you don't know, you know, again, it's the casino thing. Did the casinos know there's going to be all these tourists in town and it's the big weekend of UFC? So again, when the gate comes out, I mean, to me as a fan, I can certainly see looking at this card going like, okay, if I'm going to pay premium prices, I want, you know, this is the WrestleMania show, and this is not the WrestleMania lineup. I mean, it's really not, you know, I look at the thing, I mean, it's like off the top of my head, it's like, you know, what matches do I remember? I know Mark Munoz and Tim Boach because I did a story on Mark Munoz. I know.
Only thing I was kind of excited about, if maybe the prices were cheaper, maybe I would have gone, would have been for the Korean Zombie.
That was a great fight, and you know, but that, I will say this. I mean, it's like that's unfortunate, but they, you know, they had to pick one or the other because of what happened. So that fight was going to fall apart. That's not their fault. They really had no other choice to do. But yeah, it hurts the card. But even then, like that match is in that spot. I mean, it's not that great a number two match. Ricardo Lamas, nobody knows. The Korean Zombie people like. They just didn't. I mean, you know, things worked out between injuries and this and that. I'm sure that in their mind, you know, if they could have booked it, they would have booked. You know, look at the show that they booked on Fox in San Jose. That show was awesome.
Yeah,
I'm sure they would have loved to book that show here. It's just, you know, It's just the guys, you know, the injuries and who's ready and who's not and all the, you know, there's so many factors of that's why it's so hard to put on a super show.
Yeah.
Sometimes you have a super show because people all are ready on that day. But to go like, okay, July is our super show. I mean, because that was the idea. July and November are going to be our super shows. Sometimes you just can't make that work.
Yeah.
Because, you know, and this is what happened with July is just, they just didn't, they couldn't make it work.
Yeah, it's like the Fox, I know, I understand they want to have a big kickoff for the Fox Sports 1, but like you just said, I mean, that should be the Super Bowl card. That should be the July card. But, you know, unfortunately, it didn't work that way. But even though I'm not going to the fights, I mean, I'm so excited to see everybody at the convention. In fact, right before I called you, I got a text from Scott Walton wanting the info on where we're going to be at the suite because he's excited to see you again.
I just saw Scott at Cauliflower Alley not that long ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, just April.
Scott's a cool guy. He's a nice guy. He has some of the coolest pictures on Facebook. He's got a picture
really?
Where he's just a little kid and Andre the Giant's shoulder.
Well, I mean, I've known his dad forever, so.
Real quick, what could you tell us about his dad?
Well, he was a publicist, you know, from, I don't know, 66, 67, you know, until the promotion closed in 82. And then, you know, he managed in Tennessee, and he worked for Vince for a while doing his magazine. And, you know, so he was around for a long time. You know, he did TV announcing. He did a little bit of everything. He didn't wrestle much. I'm sure he did matches just because, you know, in Memphis as a manager, you almost have to have done matches. But he's done pretty much like he promoted, you know, he used to promote small shows in L.A., you know, promoted like El Monte, which was, you know, a little town and probably one or two others, you know, weekly towns. And he would, you know, like do the programs in the 70s. In the early 70s when they were hot, the programs for the Olympic Auditorium the St. Louis programs were probably the classiest, but the Olympic Auditoriums were these big newspaper type things. They were awesome. They were the best graphically. They were the best. They were, you know, for a couple of years, I used to get those programs every 2 weeks, and they were just the coolest of the cool, you know.
Cool.
You know, after a while, when the crowds went down, they couldn't afford to do it anymore. But when it was hot and everybody bought programs, if you ever, I don't know, you know, where you could even get them. Jeff still got some in his collection, but the early 70s, because the late 60s programs I have, and those are only like the little cardboard four-page, you know, things. But there was a run there, I'm thinking 71, 72, 73, where those programs were just tremendous that Jeff did.
That's cool. Dave, I'm not going to keep you on as long as Ship does. So we'll go ahead and start to wrap it up. I do want to thank you for doing the show, and I really can't wait to see you next week. I do have one last question I'd like to ask you, and you're probably going to laugh at me for asking this, but what do I have to do, or is there any way that I could ever earn a right to vote for the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame?
I don't know.
Well, I know you're slowly going to lose guys because of age, so keep me in mind. I'll do a good job.
Okay.
But, yeah, thank you, Dave. We really appreciate you doing the show. I'm sorry about last week. I had all kinds of problems. I'll get into them after you're off the air. But, yeah, it was kind of crazy last week. But thank you again for doing the show. And if you want to hang out with Dave Meltzer, show up to Vegas next Friday. We will be having dinner at the Fremont Hotel, and then we will be having an after party at the Riviera in the penthouse suite. So
we're gonna watch New Japan then, huh?
Yeah, I'll hook it up. I'll hook it up just for you, Dave.
Oh, great. Well, now I'm that's great. That's great.
Yeah, cool, man. So thank you, Dave. Basically, all you got to do is just hang up the phone, and we'll be done.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you. Okay, we got lucky. Dave Meltzer made the show. I think that went great. I think that was awesome. I love talking to Dave, and I'm not very disappointed that my co-host couldn't make the show today, so I got more questions in for Dave. I wasn't planning on trying to keep him the whole show, but it just he kind of went on. I hope I didn't screw up his schedule or anything. But, yeah, I thought that was great. But I guess a lot of people want to hear what the hell happened last week. And last week, I was struck by the wrath of God pretty much. Basically, what happened was is I knew I had to get gas when I got home in the morning. But what ended up happening is I had to go meet my friend Barb, and I forgot to take my damn gas card with me. So when I get to her house, I'm like, oh shit, I need to get some gas. And then the reason I was going over there is because I had to take her. She didn't have a car for the night, so I had to take her to go grocery shopping because she has her son. And so I knew the Valero was a freaking block away from the HEB that we were going to. So I figured we're cool. It'll be all right. And unfortunately, we packed in all her groceries, all her ice cream, and all these other goodies for her son. And I started to drive, and about 50 yards before the light, my car just died. Just no more gas. I tried to start it. It wouldn't start. A couple people were nice, so we pushed it off to the side into this little parking lot. And this is fucking 5 minutes before the show or 3 minutes before. I was calling Craig. I'm like, Craig, you know, I got all this shit dealing with. I go, can you please call Dave? And then Craig, I don't know how to make a three-way call. Craig, you're freaking 40 years old. How do you not know how to make a three-way call? I can't do it, dude. I can't do it. Well, he didn't say dude, but he said he can't do it. He just can't do it. And I'm like, oh, God. All right, Craig. I hang up on Craig. I'm tripping. Contreras texted me that he's stuck in a traffic jam, so I'm going to know if he can work the switchboard and get home in time. I don't know what the hell's going on. So I'm fucking freaking out. Barbara's trying to calm me down, and I'm losing my goddamn mind. And then we start the show, and then because the car stops, the AC is not on. So it's fucking Texas. It's fucking like 100 degrees, so I fucking start fucking sweating. And anytime my fucking droid gets a little moisture or water or something on the screen, it just goes fucking crazy. So my phone decided to have a fucking life of its own. You can hear me screaming. I'm trying to open up the text where I have Dave's number, and I can't. It would open and it closed. It opened and it closed. It was driving me insane. You heard me yelling a little bit on the show. Because I was busy. Y'all don't have half the clue. I should get Barbara to tell you how bad I was freaking out through all of this. And luckily, we got one of her friends was able to bring us some gas. So he put the gas in the car. By this time, I had already called and told those bastards to end the show and delete it, but apparently they kept going, and then that jerk shit called. I guess I should thank him, but he's still a jerk. So thanks, shit, but you're still a jerk. And so we start the car. We go down to 50 yards. We turn. We go into the highway. There's the Valero. I pull in. I pump the gas. I fill my car up all the way. I get in the car. I turn the key, and not a goddamn thing happens. I mean, there's still some juice, but just nothing happens. So I'm like, what the fuck? So then I do it again, and nothing happens. And then the lights start flickering, and then I'm like, oh, my God. It's got to be my alternator. So we had to have Barb's friend come back, and we loaded the groceries into his car so he could take her back and drop her off or her son off. So they were taken care of, luckily. You know, they weren't stuck with me, but I was stuck at a gas station on the opposite side of town. So luckily I have AAA. I call AAA. The guy comes, and he actually jokes me. The car starts, but and you're going to have to hear some of this on the overrun. The car starts, and he tells me, okay, turn everything on, your AC all the way, your lights all the way, your high beams, and then go to this little parking lot next door, drive around, and then we'll stop and restart it. So I do that. It's running perfect. I turn it off, and it won't turn back on. So he's like, well, it'd be safer if I take you home. So he brings me back home. So then I have to do the paper route, and I don't have a ride, so I have to call my mother, who lives in Pleasanton, which is like 30 minutes outside of San Antonio. So my mom's nice enough to come drive over here. I get in the car, I drive her back home, and then I drive back here. So I haven't slept all day. I'm tired as hell. And then I ended up having, you know, to do the paper route in my mom's car, which I'm not used to, but it wasn't too bad. The next day, I got to call AAA again to take it to the mechanic. So I take it to the mechanic, and he's telling me he's super busy, and he don't even know if he can get to it today. And I'm like, oh, Jesus Christ. And I got to a Sunday paper, and my mom's car is going to suck. So luckily, after a few hours, he calls me, and he tells me the battery is bad. It's from O'Reilly's. Take it back there. I might see if it's under warranty. So I go pick up the battery. I take it, and the dude's all, it's more than going to be prorated. But luckily, I got the battery free. So I didn't have to pay a penny for the battery. I take it back. He's like, okay, I'll put it in, and I'll check the alternator. I'll check the starter. But luckily, a couple hours later, he tells me it was just the battery. So basically, it just cost me $20 just to have the guy check everything and stuff. So it wasn't that bad financially wise, but goddamn, that just was the most nerve-wracking. Just, you know, I know we're not the most professional show. I always joke around about being professional, but I know what the show is. So don't get me wrong, but yeah, it was a big mess. It was a big mess, and I guess we're over the limit here. There is one thing I wanted to talk about. I probably shouldn't even say anything, but I will. I got some CDJ. Oh, geez, I missed the plugs. Let me get the plugs in here. Everybody, check out angrymarks.com. You can always listen to our show. Download our show and stream our show at angrymarks.com, along with a lot of other shows like Stevie J's show, The Angry Mark Show, Peter H. has a MMA show. Just shows every day of the week. You know, you'll find something that you'll enjoy. And I get this message from Stevie J, and he tells me that two guys from the Monday Night Show were talking about me and Couture the whole show. So I was kind of curious, so I listened to the show. And the show's okay. You know, they had me laughing a few times. You know, I'll check it out. Check out the Raw Reaction Show. Okay, but what really kind of, I thought was funny is these guys, they start doing the plugs. And apparently, if you go through Angry Mark's iTunes, they're like the number one show getting downloads. CBJ says that they might be exaggerating or whatever, but, you know, whatever. They talk about the number they did, which is a good number. It's a good number, but it's a number that we do way more than on Blog Talk Radio alone. So this dude, while he's doing the plug, he's laughing, and he's acting like he's helping our show out. And I appreciate it, dude. I appreciate you listening to my show. Our show, me, Couture, Craig, I appreciate you plugging my show. I really do, bro. I really appreciate it. But if you're gonna start barking like you're the top dog in the yard, or you're getting a little excited about your position, you're not, bro. You're not. As far as listeners to the Angry Marks Network, you know, yes, you know, you guys promote your show on Angry Marks. I get Block Talk and Angry Marks. So what you do isn't even close to what I do, and that's your record. So before you brag about that, you know your place, bro. Know your place. But like I say, there's a couple good dudes. Check out the show, The Raw Reaction, on Monday nights. And I'm going to go ahead and leave everybody with that, unless I can think of something before I find the theme music, which I have not.
Be the man! You gotta beat the man! You wanna find out how good you are? You're looking at the Matrix shit! Let's go hook him up! I'm gonna dog you until I wear your Texas ass out.
And hell, I might even get on top of my wife tonight.